Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Hello, it's the Motorsport Show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Lawrence Barreto, senior writer for F1.com. Lawrence, looking back on the French Grand Prix and yet another win for Mercedes and for Lewis Hamilton.
I wasn't sure if when we came back this weekend we'd be talking about another Lewis Hamilton victory. But then I guess after seven victories for Mercedes beforehand, I probably should have seen this one coming. Mercedes were the stronger of the two teams going into France, and we did expect Ferrari to offer more of a challenge. And unfortunately, it didn't materialise. It didn't help so much that Sebastian Vettel wasn't on form, and I thought he would have had a bounce back from Canada after like a strong result. I know he didn't win, but I thought he was going to take some confidence for that, and unfortunately we just didn't see that at all over the course of the weekend. It was actually his teammate Charles Leclerc who was the stronger of the two Ferrari drivers. The interesting thing I think with Lewis over the French Grand Prix weekend is he wasn't even looking that good on Friday practice. Valtteri Bottas, his teammate, was looking pretty good, and I think it wasn't until qualifying that it really became clear that Lewis could really take pole and the victory. So an interesting weekend all round. Perhaps not the most exciting race, but Lewis won't care about that because it's another victory.
In the end, Bottas finished really quite a long way behind Hamilton. Why was no one able to get closer?
I think it's just because Lewis Hamilton is just that much better than everyone else on the grid. Bottas has actually been driving really well this year, which probably says a lot more about how well Lewis is driving. They've obviously got the same car, the same equipment. The team won't favour either driver, so they've got a fair opportunity. It was just that Bottas couldn't hook it together when it mattered. So the first mistake was in qualifying. He got caught out by the wind. So it's very windy conditions at Paul Ricard, and he got caught out by the wind, and that kind of threw his pole position challenge off route. Once you're behind Lewis Hamilton, it's very, very difficult to pass. And he's a very good defensive driver. Then come race day, Lewis was just in a league of his own, really. He was able to lap in a way that no one else could do that, and Bottas couldn't get into the same rhythm, and therein lies that gap.
Why do you think Ferrari weren't better able to capitalise this time around? Because the past couple of Grand Prix, in our build-up to them, we've been saying, you know what, this is a circuit that could favour Ferrari, and yet no change.
So I'd say, relatively speaking, Ferrari were actually closer this weekend. So I'm just in terms of there wasn't a massive gap or massive chasm behind them. The difference was that they didn't have their lead driver performing. So I think if Sebastian Vettel had driven to the ability that he can, he would have challenged Bottas definitely for P2, and he definitely would have been on the front row, I think.
Do you think Vettel has been put off by the time penalty and all of the ongoing argument around that?
I didn't think after Canada that was the case, but now I'm starting to think that possibly it was. On Thursday, when he was talking to the media, he was incredibly relaxed, and that's kind of made me think, oh, well, you know, maybe I was right in saying that he's going to have a bounce back. But then he got in the car and he couldn't find a rhythm, and it was the same old story that we've seen so often this year. He does look like he's just off his game, and I do think that the penalty issue, so they obviously had the penalty appeal or the right to review, should we say, in France, and the FIA decided not to pursue that path, and you know, that is that now. We won't be talking about that again. But perhaps that did have a negative impact on the way that he dealt with the weekend going forward.
Yeah, it's a really, really tough one to recover, because even if just subconsciously he's still a bit angry, still feels hard done by, that is going to lead you to make mistakes.
Definitely. And I think obviously he'll never admit that, and I guess he doesn't really feel like that's what's happening. But subconsciously, like you said, I think it probably is happening. He knows now that it's been since the Belgian Grand Prix last summer that he last won a Grand Prix. It's all well and good saying it doesn't bother me, you know, that I haven't won a race since then. But he's supposed to be Lewis Hamilton's main title challenger, and he hasn't won a race since last August. So that's got to play on his mind.
Should we look at Vettel and feel sorry for him? In the sense that if he were operating in another era and wasn't having to compete with Hamilton, actually, he could be a real star.
I guess so, but then he operated earlier when he had his dominance at Red Bull. He was very strong, and he was that guy who everyone was thinking, well, if he wasn't around, this such and such would have been on top of the pile. I think he is unlucky that he's competing against Lewis Hamilton at a time when not only is Lewis driving at the peak of his career, but he's also in the car that is the best. And I think those two things together, it is very unfortunate for everyone else on the grid.
One thing that we were discussing last week is the prospect of a Mercedes unbeaten season, which was looking not all that likely last week, of course, slightly more likely this week. With each passing week, it looks less like someone's going to get the better of Hamilton. Can he actually do it? Can they as a team go all the way?
You know what? I think you're right in that as the weeks go by, I think the chances of it happening increase. So that was their 10th straight victory, if you take into account the victories from the end of last year. If they win in Austria, that'll be 11. That equals the record that McLaren set in 1988. And that kind of just shows you, so 88, so that was the 30-odd years ago that last happened. It just shows you what an achievement it is to win that many races. And that team was super dominant, that McLaren team. They didn't manage to do it. I still don't think that Mercedes are going to be able to get through the whole year without that kind of reliability issue that will prevent them from winning a Grand Prix. So if you take Austria coming up, for example, last year they had a double DNF, so neither Mercedes finished. I'm not going to say that that's going to happen this time round, and I'm not saying it was track specific, but I would say in the last couple of races, Mercedes have had two major problems, what Toto described as required open heart surgery. So they had to like tear the car apart to get it back into the kind of shape that they needed to, that they were confident it was going to be reliable. And that's not a team that is kind of then resting on its laurels and is very comfortable with where it is. So I think problems will happen. It's just the nature of the sport. These things happen. They're working with these cars with thousands of components they're put together, and I just can't see how in the remaining races, and we're still only just over a third of the way through the season, how Mercedes aren't going to have another problem.
Some in the world of F1 are still talking about the possible allure of Ferrari for Hamilton. The fact that wearing that red, driving that iconic car, is something that is a pull, even if the Mercedes car might be a bit better. If he were to jump ship in a couple of seasons' time, what happens to Vettel and Leclerc? Who gets shunted aside?
I would be almost certain it would be Vettel, actually, that would get shunted, because Leclerc is supposed to be the star of the future, not only for Ferrari, but for Formula One. And I think that you saw a glimpse in France about how he is going to be capable of doing that. He drove a very strong weekend. And I think by the time you get to the end of next season, he'll have 2 years under his belt at Ferrari. He'll have built support with the rest of the engineers and the mechanics. And I think he'll be ready to really take that title challenge. Where does Sebastian Vettel go after that? Well, I'm not sure. I would suggest it's probably going to be outside of F1, because I'm not sure that a seat at Red Bull return there or at Mercedes is going to be possible.
Well, is that another element of this rivalry then? That Vettel isn't just looking over his shoulder at someone who's overtaken him in the F1 pecking order, but also in the sense that Hamilton could drive him out, not just of the Ferrari team, but the sport as a whole?
I'm sure he hasn't missed the fact that time is running out for him. In Formula One, you can go on until you're 40. Like Kimi Raikkonen, by the end of next year with Alfa Romeo, he's going to be 40 years old. So Sebastian Vettel's still got years left in him. The trouble is, he hasn't got years left in him in a car that is capable of winning the world title. I think if you ever drive a Ferrari, the chances are it's going to be very cool and you're going to be really happy that you've had the opportunity to drive for them. But the chances of you having a car that's capable of winning the world title is minimal. I mean, Schumacher took 5 years before he won on that run of five world championships in a row. I think Sebastian Vettel's probably sitting there thinking, well, have I made the wrong move here? You know, I probably got carried away by the fact that I'd be driving for Ferrari. And here I am several years later. And no, not really any closer to winning the world title. I don't really feel like since he's joined there was ever a genuine point where I thought he could actually win the title.
Concerning at times for Vettel, perhaps, but the focus has to be on the excellence of Lewis Hamilton. Coming up, we'll be asking what makes him so good.
This is Love Sport.
It's the Motorsport Show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Lawrence Barreto, senior writer for F1. And I'm delighted to say that we're joined on the line by Giles Richards, who is F1 correspondent for The Guardian. Good evening, Giles. Thanks for joining us. What makes Lewis Hamilton so good?
Sorry, good evening, boys. How are you doing?
Very well, thank
you.
Very
well, thank you.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thanks. I'm in Vienna on my way down to the Red Bull Ring for next week's race.
Very nice.
What makes Lewis Hamilton so good?
That's the question.
Yeah, what have you got? A couple of hours. It's an interesting question, because obviously for many people who are listening, what's making him so good is to a certain extent making the sport slightly boring at the front. But let's be straight about this straight away. This isn't Lewis's fault. The reason the race in France, for example, was so uninspiring was partly because obviously the Mercedes was very dominant there, but also it is partly because Lewis is so good. And I think before we go into why, we really should, it's important to remember to celebrate this fact. I mean, I've long been a golf fan and a cricket fan, and I have compared this period to when Tiger was at his best. And during that period, when Tiger was winning everything, it was an absolute privilege to be watching a sportsman at the peak of his powers. And I think it is the same can be said for Lewis right now. I mean, it's like when Michael was dominating. It can make for less than exciting races. But at the same time, I really think it's important we should appreciate that this is a driver who is absolutely second to none at the moment, and comes along once in a generation.
Giles, with that in mind, do you think Lewis is underappreciated by F1 fans and people outside the sport at the moment? Because I said this was going to be our talking point when I was doing a handover on the Drive show, and Patrick Christie's the co-presenter said, well, is he all that? Are we failing to recognise the once in a generation talent we've got in front of us?
Yes. The simple answer to that is, I think yes, it is, and he is appreciated. There's no doubt about that. He is greatly loved. I mean, Silverstone will be a sellout this year. British fans adore him, and it's also important to remember that just how big a draw he is across the world. I mean, I was in China earlier. It's astonishing how many Chinese people you will see with Lewis Hamilton gear on in the crowd. And you see this at every race. You see it at Monaco. You see it in France. He's an absolute phenomenon. So he's definitely not underappreciated. But he is equally, I think, because he's been so dominant and Mercedes have been so dominant, I think there is an element that his skill has been taken for granted. But it's very important to remember this has not come easily or quickly, and I'll illustrate that very quickly by just bringing you back many years to when I had fewer grey hairs. But back in 2006 at Silverstone, he was in GP2, and that year he went from eighth to win the race, and there were some hardcore fans there who saw that and knew who he was at the time and appreciated that, a very good friend of mine and a great colleague, Oliver Owen, who is the editor of the superb Sport 500 website, interviewed him at the time. And he said then, in 2006 this was, he was still a kid, pre-McLaren days, he said, I am working my arse off. And he has never stopped doing that ever since. And a year later, he was at McLaren in his debut season, and Oliver interviewed him again at Paul Ricard testing. And he said, the interview was delayed while Lewis had done 100 laps that day. He'd done a 2.5-hour debriefing. And then he'd sat down looking at data, analysing data on his own personal laptop. And the interview was delayed until Lewis was happy that he'd analysed his data. And that was his first year in Formula One. Now, that work ethic has stayed with him ever since. And it's something that is because people see the private jet and they see the fashion shows and they see him having a good time and he's out.
Is the private jet golden?
Pictures himself. Sorry?
Is the private jet golden?
It used to be red, didn't it, I think?
No, it's red.
Yeah. Okay,
it's red.
But any private jets that's a silly colour, I think you're reasonably coming into fire there, aren't you?
Well, you are. I mean, fair enough. And look, I mean, you know, he's living this life to the full, and who can blame him? But the point I'm making there is that the behind all that, and Mercedes know this, behind that, the work ethic he's kept up all that time is absolutely exceptional. And he continues it to this day. And Mercedes know this because they allow him to go and do all these things, which in other drivers probably wouldn't be allowed, because they know when he turns up at the track, he is on immediately. He's absolutely on it, and he's completely focused. And that's something he has developed since 2007, 2006, that has brought him to this pinnacle. Again, that brings back to Tiger Woods, for example. When Tiger reached his peak, he made it look effortless, and Lewis is making it look effortless at the moment. And that is, I guess, why it feels like, well, it's, what happened on Sunday? Well, the cars went around in circles and Lewis Hamilton won again, which is what everyone used to say when Michael was driving.
I think it's that mental strength that he's developed, particularly since he's gone to Mercedes, which has allowed him to, like you were saying, Giles, go away and do his fashion line, or go away and make music, or go away and, I don't know, go surfing or whatever it is he's doing these days. Because I think that he can plug himself out of Formula One very easily and then plug himself back in, and he can get on it in a way that I don't think I can think of many F1 drivers in the history, and definitely as long as I've been covering Formula One, are able to do. He can just turn it on when it matters.
No, you're absolutely right, mate. I mean, that's a completely astute observation. But and it is, there is a mental control there that, again, is I think specific to very, very high level successful athletes. What he's exhibiting right now is not only the skills that he had when he was 20, 21, but he has combined them with a level of mental control, calm, experience and competence that means he's a complete package. It is really incredible to watch. It's that, you know, when you see him race and then speak to him, an hour after climbing out of the car. A decade ago, he was a little bit up and down in emotionally at these times, but now he is absolutely centered, and it's clear that he is bringing that to the track. He's coming in, he's switching on, he's mentally absolutely on top of it, and when things don't go well, which to be fair is very infrequent these days, but when things don't go well, he copes with it very well. People have made a big deal about, for example, you know, like, oh, he's always whining over the radio, but if you look at it, if you listen to it carefully, it's not whining. What he's doing is talking through the issues he's having, and that is his way of dealing with them. He's not getting, it's very important this, he's not getting angry, and he's not venting on anyone. He is just talking them through.
And I keep using that line to my girlfriend, it doesn't get me very far. I'm not whining, I'm just talking it through.
Yeah.
Probably get very short shrift, don't you?
You know, maybe if you were Lewis, you'd get away with it.
Yeah, quite possibly. If I had a red private jet, she might be more lenient. In terms of,
you know, we'd all do better with a red private jet. I think
that is probably true. In terms of Hamilton's physique, is there anything naturally there that makes him more naturally talented as an F1 driver?
Well, literally in physical terms.
Yeah.
No, I don't think there is. I mean, he works. Very hard to stay in shape, but nowadays they all do. There's no way out of that. Although he has made a very big deal out of going completely vegan over the last couple of years, and he believes that has made a massive difference to his health and his physical shape. And I wouldn't surprise me if it has. I mean, you know, I gave up carbs a few years ago, and I'm half the man I used to be. But so I'm sure that is the case. But he doesn't. I don't think physically. No, I don't. I honestly don't think there is any difference. I think if you put him against the top drivers, you put him against Sebastian and Max and people, they would all be very much in a similar range in terms of physicality.
So does he just work the hardest?
I think it's partly working the hardest, and it's also partly, and it's partly that I believe he is. Driving on another level now to everyone. I honestly don't think Sebastian Vettel has any fear. He has any fear of Sebastian Vettel anymore now. I think he's beaten him repeatedly in the last three seasons, this season and the last two, when in many occasions the Ferrari was the better car. And I think he knows, Lewis knows he's a better driver now, and he knows. And with people like Max, Max is going to be a great driver, and he is already a great driver. And when he's in a more competitive car, which I hope will occur when Lewis is still driving, he will be a fearsome competitor. But at the moment, Max is at a place where Lewis was a decade ago. So as I said before, Lewis has it's not just the skill and the physicality, it's the experience and his control, his mental attitude, in a way it's the maturity. And I mean, to a certain extent, there's a caveat here that obviously he's in a sport where unlike golf, for example, or tennis, where an injury could really set you back, he hasn't been afflicted by that. So when you reach this level of dominance, when you reach this level of almost, I'm loath to say it, but almost perfection, then as long as you stay fit and you stay in a decent car, then you are always going to be right at the front. And I would say that if Lewis had been in a Ferrari in the last two seasons, he would have been in the championship fight right to the end.
Fascinating stuff, Giles. Thanks ever so much for your time. Giles Richards there, F1 correspondent for The Guardian. Now, he's given us the inside line, as it were, on Lewis Hamilton, the driver. But the wonderful Lawrence Barreto, my co-host, is here to give us the inside line on Lewis Hamilton, the man. Because, Lawrence, I gather you know him rather well.
So I'm very lucky in that the start of my career in journalism and reporting Formula One kind of coincided with when Lewis Hamilton was just about to enter Formula One. So the first time that I actually met him was in GP2, which is...
Were you both 12?
We were pretty baby-faced, I think, when we both met, yeah. We also both had shaved heads, interestingly enough.
Really?
Yeah, so yeah.
You had a shaved head?
I did, yeah.
I really can't imagine that. Do you have any photos?
Yeah, I do. Not okay. With me, fortunately.
That's for next week.
And it just helped that we were obviously kind of going through sort of the championships and arriving at Formula One sort of similar time. He was obviously an F1 driver, I was a journalist, so we're at different levels anyway. But he was also very nice in that he just gave time to journalists. So when I first met him, he was with his dad, Anthony Hamilton, and we were in the paddock, and he'd just had a really bad session. So he was out in Hungary, and you could see he was in a bad mood. But when he saw that I was coming over, and we'd spoken a few times beforehand, he kind of instantly perked up and sat there for 15-20 minutes discussing the...
Maybe it's just you, Lawrence.
I don't think so. I think it was more that he was just at that time, he was very aware that he needed to make the effort. I think he what Lewis has always got is that he understands what he needs to do to be successful, and it's not just be quick on track, it's get a team around you that can help you be the best. It's work with the people or work with journalists so that hopefully that they understand what you're doing and so that they can report things in the best possible way, in the most informed way. And I think even at a young age, he really got that. So I think that's why he just gave me the time of day. And it was the same with other journalists. I think if you ask them at that stage of his career, he really genuinely gave time.
So he knew everybody's names. When he saw you coming, he would know it was you, all of that.
Exactly. So that's the other thing I was going to say, is that when you passed him in the paddock, and even to this day, when you pass him and you see him, whether in an airport or hotel lobby, he'll always say, "Hi, Lawrence," and call you by your name. Well, obviously, yeah. If your name is Lawrence.
Good effort.
But
I still don't think he does it for everyone. Maybe he just remembers your name, and every time he sees an F1 journalist, he just goes, "Hi, Lawrence," and hopes.
Well, he could well do. So he's got a minimal hit rate then at that point. But it sounds good for me, so when I hear it. And he'll always do it. He won't always stop and have a proper chat. He's busy, and I get that. We're not there to be their friends. We're kind of just there to kind of work with them. But I think it's a nice touch to then make the effort to remember your name. And I remember when I interviewed him at Mercedes-Benz World a few years ago, he went out and had given a load of fans some passenger rides. And then we had an interview slot booked in afterwards. And we'd talked about my family beforehand. And the first thing he said to me was like, "How are you? How's your sister? How's your parents?" kind of thing. In a way that most interviewees just don't do that.
No.
Which I just thought is always a nice touch, kind of to open the interview, and it just makes everything a bit more relaxed. And incidentally, actually, during that interview, one thing Lewis also always has at an interview, if it's a one-to-one interview, is food.
So when you say food, Are we talking the burgers of last week, or are we on the different end of the culinary spectrum?
Yep, so we're not talking fast food, we're not talking meals, we're talking snacks, I guess.
Okay.
So when we first had to sit down at McLaren, the McLaren Technology Centre in Woking, went into this room, and in the middle of the table was a tray of snacks. Now, we're talking sweet snacks at this stage, so we're talking about 10 years ago, I think. Then he was a bit younger, hadn't obviously begun this vegan diet. There were Jaffa cakes, strawberry laces, and an array of other kind of sweet products, others available.
So what did you go for? That's the first question.
So I went for the Jaffa cake. Well, the thing
is, solid choice.
He asked me, well, what would you like? So which was nice before, you know, rather just tuck it into himself. So I went for Jaffa cakes, and it was one of those snack packs, so you get like three or four.
Very nice. I hope you asked Lewis Hamilton the biggest question of all, which is where he comes down on the fierce is a Jaffa cake a cake or a biscuit debate.
Yes, and it's a cake. Well, at the time he believed it was a cake.
Really?
Which I believe is a cake.
Interesting.
Because it's called a Jaffa cake, so I kind of feel like if they've called it a cake, we should believe it's a cake.
Doesn't necessarily mean you should trust them. We know you've gone for the Jaffa cake. Did Lewis eat the snacks? Was this one of those things where they were just there for you guys, or were they there nominally for you so that he could eat sweets?
No, he definitely ate the Jaffa cake. So
it was the Jaffa cakes he wanted as well.
So he had the Jaffa cakes first, and then once we got into the conversation, he went for the strawberry laces.
Right, because I want to ask about the strawberry laces. Our producer's looking very chuffed, because as soon as this topic came up, he got in my ear and said, strawberry laces, any day, you've got to pick the strawberry laces. But anyone who is going for the strawberry laces in this context, and I include Lewis Hamilton in that, is not considering the nature of an interview. A strawberry lace would be very, very low. Think about how you've got to eat a strawberry lace. Very low on my list of things to eat while trying to... He's now saying much rarer than Jaffa cakes. It's not a Pokemon. If you want some strawberry laces, go and get some strawberry laces. You know what I mean, though? Is he there asked, what do you think of Max Verstappen? Well, I'll answer that question with half a strawberry lace hanging out my mouth. It's just not practical.
It's... not the most practical snack, perhaps, for an interview, but at least we went. It wasn't broadcast, so it was just a chat as if we were just at a table with no one looking at us. So I guess I didn't mind so much that he was chewing through a strawberry lace as he was chatting to me.
Did he speak with his mouth full?
No.
Okay, and did he chew with his mouth closed?
Yes.
Okay, so perfect manners, we'll say. And beyond just...
And he didn't get any strawberry laces stuck in his teeth either. So
okay,
that was good.
Okay, so he's getting high points for manners, no elbows on tables or anything like that. You've said, of course, he remembers your name, which, fair play, because it sounds like a minor thing, but I imagine lots of them don't. In terms of the interview themselves, what's he like? Is he jokey? Is he serious? What's the tone?
So to start with... There is small talk in a way that often you'll do an interview and they'll just want to crack straight on. So there's a little bit of small talk. I think there is jokey in that he's trying to be relaxed about it. And I think when he was at McLaren in the very early years, he tried a little bit too hard, I think. Nowadays, if you interview him, he's much more relaxed. But he's also, you can see that he's thought about what he's going to say. So that's the one thing I do feel that he does these days, is he prepares for an interview. And I don't mean that means he's been media trained and he's been told what to say. I just mean that if he knows what the theme of the interview is, he's gone away and thought about what he's going to say, whether it's instances in the past that he wants to talk about, or if we're going to go into quite detail aspect of things, he's actually gone away and thought about it. So there's not like lots of ums and ahs. He's not just saying things for the sake of it. He's actually trying to give you an insight into not only him, but the way that he approaches Formula One, his viewpoint. He's definitely not afraid to give his opinion.
So do you expect to see him as a broadcaster once his career's over?
I think he could do it, but I don't think we'll see him as a broadcaster, because I just don't think he's interested. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
It's fine, Lewis. It's a rubbish job. I've always said that.
The thing is, if you could go off and design your own clothing range, Johnny...
No, I would sit right here with a microphone in front. Can you imagine me designing a clothing range? Actually, to be fair, I'm not taking fashion tips to the man whose private jet is red, quite frankly. I think that is the worst conceivable advert for Lewis Hamilton's clothes range. No, I know what you mean. He's got bigger fish to fry.
I think so, and we might see him kind of pop in now and then to be like an expert on a TV show as a pundit.
Love Sport Radio.
And Love Sport Radio, exactly. Well, he's always available. It's always available to come in if he wants to join the show. I think he just... There's so many things. He's so dedicated, committed, driven, that I think there's so many things he wants to tick off that he would be difficult for him to fit broadcasting in. Not that
so
he wouldn't want to try and do it.
So what are his ambitions, do you think?
So I think he wants to pursue more down the fashion route, but I think he also wants to do music. I think that's what we'll see more of when he leaves Formula One.
Is he any good? And when we say music, what kind of music are we talking?
Well, I believe that he spends a lot of time in a studio with various artists that people will know better than I.
Give me
about
names.
about who they are. And I think that he... And apparently he's made lots of music, but he won't release it to anyone because he doesn't want anyone to hear it yet. So whether that means it's good or not, I don't
really
know.
I really hope it's just him making F1 car noises into a microphone. Number one. Straight to number one, Lewis. You heard it here first. So he sounds like a lovely boy.
Yeah, a really nice guy.
Where does he rank in terms of the very nicest F1 drivers? Where would you place him? Does he get a podium finish?
I think he... You know what? This is why it's had harsh. I think he's just off the podium. But that's...
Is that because he hasn't had a burger with you like Carlos Sainz?
Yeah, well, it would have to be a plant-based burger.
Of course. So I'm not... Very tedious.
I'm not certain how good that's going to be.
No, so, fair enough. Okay, so who are the top three then? And where does Hamilton
place? Are we talking kind of current Formula One drivers?
Anyone you've interviewed. Not including me.
Oh, well, that makes it much harder than Johnny. So I would put Sebastian Vettel up there as nice guy.
So he's winning something.
I'd put Jenson Button in there.
Yeah.
And I would put... It has to be a former driver, doesn't it? Nigel Mansell.
Okay, Nigel Mansell. And where does Hamilton rank?
Fourth.
Okay. Well, he's in the mix and he deserves to be. We'll let him get off to enjoy a strawberry lace. But coming up, are McLaren finally on their way back up, even without Lewis? Don't go anywhere.
This is Love Sport.
It's the Motorsport Show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Lawrence Barreto, senior writer for F1.com. And we're joined on the line by Kate Walker, New York Times F1 writer. Good evening, Kate. Thanks for joining us. The focus of the show so far has been Lewis Hamilton, but under the radar, this was an encouraging performance from McLaren. Are they finally on their way back up?
Well, it looks like it, but and that seems to be the received wisdom. But one of the things that we've been forgetting, really, is that while McLaren did have a good weekend in France in terms of qualifying, they've actually held steadily on to P4 in the Constructors' Championship for much of the season. I mean, even in a points-free race in Spain, they held on to that position. So really, they've actually been quietly good, and we've only just noticed, I think, is really the situation.
This time last year, they had a good start, and they were up towards this kind of point in the championship, fourth or fifth, Kate. But I feel like this year, something's different. They've obviously had a lot of management changes, a lot of structural changes back at McLaren Technology Centre. And there's just something...
I think Seidel's the difference.
Oh, well, there you go. Tell me why.
Well, if you look at McLaren, They've, for the last decade, or most of a decade, they have been a small team with a big budget and big resources, and they've been underperforming for their capabilities. And Seidel came in and identified that the team were great, but that the way that they were performing was really what needed to change. And I think that really it's just a change in morale. They've changed the reporting structure that happened under Zak Brown. People have now got more accountability. But... they're also allowed to make mistakes to contribute. And I think that freedom of attitude has really liberated the team to just do better.
He's quite an impressive character. That's the one thing that I've kind of picked up when I've spent time kind of in the paddock this year. And I think the way that he has approached dealing with people in the team has lifted it. You look at a McLaren mechanic or an engineer or anyone who works for the team these days, and they do look pretty happy.
Yeah, they've got, and this is a completely unprofessional way of looking at it, but they've got a swagger that they've been missing over the last 4 or 5 years. They walk through the paddock with a confidence that we haven't seen from McLaren since they last stood on podiums.
What do you think is keeping them off the very top?
Well, they're not Ferrari, Mercedes or Red Bull.
Is that in terms of cars? Is that in terms of drivers? Is it both?
Oh, it's the engine, it's the drivers. And you have to remember, this is the first time in a decade that McLaren haven't had at least one world champion in their car.
And I think, I guess, we can't be too hard on Carlos Sainz and Lando Norris. They're both very, well, reasonably young drivers. Lando's obviously a rookie. This is his fifth season. And I agree that they're not world champion status. And I guess it's more of a project, and we've just got to wait and see how they perform kind of in the years to come. But I think the early signs are very good. Lando looks like a bit of a star of the future, and Carlos seems to be taking up that kind of mantle of a lead driver.
Yeah, and then on the technical side, don't forget that the longer James Key is around, the more influence he's going to have on the cars as well. I mean, it's cumulative.
So,
yeah, they've laid the groundwork.
So James Key is a technical director who worked at Toro Rosso, and he really made a name for himself for just delivering a car that was very good on a small budget. And I think going to McLaren, hopefully with a bigger resource and with a good technical team around him, that will help them move forward. In Formula One, you can't make giant steps, and I think that's what McLaren has suddenly realised, especially with, like you were saying, Sale coming in. I just feel like they now feel that they need to take baby steps, but as long as they keep making those steps forward, eventually they can get back to the top. Whether they can compete with the likes of Mercedes and Ferrari and Red Bull, like you suggested earlier, Kate, is another question, and we might have to wait until the 2021 regulations kick in to hopefully
level even beyond. And it took Mercedes what 4 years from getting in to start dominating, and they'd been practicing for 2014 from 2010 onwards. In effect, you know, success in Formula One is a slow process. It's not a matter of even one or two seasons. It's longer than that if you want to dominate.
But I think there are positives to take, and I feel like looking ahead to the rest of the season, if they can kind of hold fourth position and kind of develop in the way that they have been developing in season and hold off Renault, who are a manufacturer and have got a very substantial budget, I think that will represent a very good season for McLaren. And when you have a positive season like that, it will encourage more people to want to go and work there. It will encourage people who work in there to stay. Hopefully it will encourage more back in, so then they can get more money into the team. It's just this, that what McLaren really need is a good, strong season, and I can't remember the last time they had one of them.
Well, and the advantage they've got at the moment, of course, is that they're outperforming their engine supplier. And I'm not enough of a stats fan to be able to know when was the last time that actually happened with any regularity. It's probably got to be Red Bull and Renault or something. But even then, there wasn't enough of a crossover, I don't think.
No, agreed.
You mentioned Lando Norris earlier, Kate. How good do you think he can become?
I think Lando is very good. But I have to say, I am less excited by him than I am by either Albon or Russell, the other two new drivers racing under British flags. And Alexander Albon is Thai but British born, so he counts as both. But the three of them were the ones to watch in Formula 2 last year. They're all incredibly talented. But yeah, in my opinion, Albon and Russell are the two that we should be watching for future British stars rather than Lando.
Is this next generation breaking through going to be cursed by the spectre of Lewis Hamilton, whatever happens? Because they're not going to be as good as he is, and they're always going to be compared to him.
Well, Sebastian Vettel did quite well despite having the spectre of Michael Schumacher. So, if we can create somebody who's able to perform at the Vettel level of talent in the wake of Lewis, that's no shame. I mean, Vettel is a four-time world champion rather than an 70-million-time world champion, but he's still got an awful lot of championship silverware.
I think, you're right. I think a lot of people can be quite harsh on Vettel. He has a four-time world champion, and it might have been a long, long time ago, but he did have to win those championships, even if he had the best car. I think kind of going back to McLaren and looking at where they stand overall, they've had a few tough couple of years when they had Honda as their engine supplier, and they probably didn't deal with that situation very well. So they at least feel like they've learned some lessons from that whole saga, I guess. And they're dealing much more with their now engine supplier, Renault, a lot better. I think with Zak Brown, he's made a few changes, and some of them haven't worked brilliantly, but maybe his latest hire is the one that's really going to turn these things around, this team around.
I'm with you. I think we have to be positive. I mean, McLaren are a great team. They've got an awful lot of very capable people, and they've got one of the best facilities in the paddock. On the circuit, not just their motorhome, but their factory. They have all of the ingredients they need for success.
Kate, I'm going to leave you with a question out of nowhere, which is, can Mercedes go invincible this season?
I'm going to say no, because every time I think that they are going to be invincible, something really small comes along. I think that if Mercedes lose a race this year, it's going to be to an O-ring that costs 2.5p to buy.
Okay, well, that's a very good tip indeed. Kate, thank you for your time. Kate Walker, their New York Times F1 writer. Fantastic stuff. Interesting to hear those tips for the new generation of British talent as well. Some of them will be in action in this weekend's Austrian Grand Prix. Coming up, what can we expect?
This is Love Sport. Sport.
You're with Johnny Burrow and Lawrence Barreto here on Love Sport Radio for the Motorsport Show, and we're casting our eyes forward to this weekend's Austrian Grand Prix. Lawrence, what kind of circuit is this?
So it's quite an unusual circuit. It's the second highest on the calendar. So what I mean by that is the altitude will affect the way that the cars run.
Makes it a lot harder to run.
We're definitely
get breathless.
So I track run all of the circuits, and this is one of the toughest ones to do. Obviously, the hardest one is Mexico, where the altitude's even tougher. But that means it's tougher on the cars, and cooling is a massive issue. And Mercedes have had, I wouldn't say problems with it, because that's not what the reason for the failures that they've had in the past. But that's perhaps one of the bigger challenges for a team like them. And that is why I feel like, and I know I've said this quite often on the show, but I feel like Ferrari have got a chance here this weekend. Now, every time I've said that, they've let me down every time, and I really hope that they won't be letting me down again this weekend. But the reason why I say that is because it's a shorter circuit, and I don't mean just mean that means they'll be closer because of that. But the way that the nature of the straights and the medium to slow speed corners suit them a little bit better. The corners where they've been struggling, and there were plenty of them at Paul Ricard, aren't so prevalent here in Austria. So it's for those two reasons, with that power advantage, that I feel like this weekend they should be closer, if not at least with a car able to challenge the front row, challenge that Mercedes monopoly. Now, obviously, you need a lot of things to happen for them to make the most of that. Firstly, you need Sebastian Vettel to drive in the way that we know he can. We need Charles Leclerc to drive at the level that he showed he can in France. And we probably need a mistake from Mercedes, whether that's Lewis or Bottas making a mistake, for something to really mix up the front row. But I think come race day, and the temperatures are going to be scorching. Today I saw the temperatures were 33 degrees. It's going to get even hotter this weekend. That means the tyres are going to be a problem.
Beyond just the cars, how hot does it get within them for the drivers? How good's the aircon?
Not good at all.
Really?
Because they can't
waste weight.
Well, they don't want to, exactly. So, and it can get very, very hot. In France, for example, Daniel Ricciardo's water bottle, they didn't connect it, so he had no drink for the whole race. So that's not so bad in a race like France, but if that happened in Singapore, where the humidity levels are massive, I would be surprised if he felt very good when he got out of the car at the end of the race. But in terms of, the conditions, at a race like Austria, because it's going to be dry heat, it's not going to be so much of a problem. When it's warm, it's the humid conditions that tend to be a problem. Often when Malaysia was on the calendar, you'd see drivers walking around with like vests with ice packs on them to try and keep them cool. And get their body temperature down before they got in the car. But the thing is, as soon as you get going, temperatures rise, and there's not a great deal that you can do about it.
In terms of a failure from a Ferrari perspective, if they don't manage to get something this weekend, how much is that pressure building?
I think this is part of the problem why, even though they should be strong here, they might struggle and cave under the pressure, because this Austria is the last one for a while, I think, that they're going to have a genuine chance of winning, and that they'll know that. The next race, really, that I would say that they've got a really good chance of winning is Belgium, and that's not too after the summer break. By then, both championships could be done. I mean, you know, certain things are going to have to happen for that to happen, but it's still mathematically possible for both championships to be done by then, and that would be a disaster. And Ferrari don't want to be leaving it up until that point before they can finally get in with a chance. I really feel that if Ferrari can just get a win under their belt, I think that would really help the confidence within Maranello, and success breeds success. But I do think that the pressure that is being put on them now heading to Austria, because they know this is a circuit that they should perform at, it could have a negative aspect, and that's what's concerning, because at the moment Mercedes are operating at such a high level that they almost don't care what everyone else is doing. They just need to get on with it, and they've got that freedom to go out there and do what they can to succeed.
And in terms of Mercedes as a team, are we straightforwardly expecting Hamilton to be the man to win it, or could Bottas actually squeak one as well?
So this is a circuit where Bottas is actually pretty handy. He was leading the race last year, and he probably would have won that race if it wasn't for a hydraulic issue. So I feel like the Bottas will have marked this one out before the start of the season as one that he could really get Lewis, and he needs to, because Lewis has won 6 out of the last 7 races. He has got the momentum. If you remember, after round 4, Bottas was actually leading the championship fight, and he probably thought he's in with the fight.
So what's the dynamic between the two men like? Is Bottas delighted to see his teammate doing so well?
Of course he's not.
Or is there's an element of ego there?
Yeah, I think they'll say all the right things, and there's clearly a huge respect between the drivers, and Lewis was praising the performance that Bottas put in the last race. But it's very easy, I guess, to do that when you're the winner and your teammates in second place. I think Bottas this year genuinely feels like he can take it to Lewis. Whether he can or not is a different matter, and he hasn't really proved that consistently enough. But I feel like they get on well as a pairing, and they work together well as a pairing, and I think that has a more positive impact for Lewis than it does for Valtteri.
Do you think Lewis would be a noble loser if Bottas won?
Oh yeah, I think if Bottas goes and wins a race, then Lewis is going to do the right thing and congratulate him, and he'll be genuine in it. I think perhaps if we were in a title decider, and Bottas won, and that many won the title, well, no, he's not going to do that. But then what sports person would do? Like, the instant reaction is going to be that of utter defeat and resignation that he's missed out. But I think if Bottas goes and wins this weekend, Lewis Hamilton's confidence is so high that he probably won't be that worried.
Are there any dark horses you could point out for us in Austria?
So last year's winner was Max Verstappen. So the track is called the Red Bull Ring. So it's Red Bull's home race. Obviously, that doesn't necessarily mean they will go well there, but it so happens that the track layout does suit their car rather. You would expect them to be a reasonable. They put in a reasonable performance this weekend, and if things don't quite go right, Max Verstappen's driving at such a high level at the moment. He's out driving that car that he could be in with a shout if things go his way.
If you say he's out driving his car, if Verstappen and Hamilton swapped cars, what kind of championship would we be seeing?
So I think we would be actually quite a similar one, because for the very fact that Lewis is out driving his car, Max is out driving their car. And if those are the two drivers at the moment in Formula One who are performing at the highest level, what would be brilliant is to see them both in the same car, because I think Max is the only one on the grid who can get Lewis Hamilton worried. So we were talking earlier about Giles, and with Giles, about how Lewis doesn't seem that scared of anyone anymore. I think that is true, apart from Max. I think if Max was in a car that was capable of challenging Lewis on a level playing field, Lewis would be worried about Max, because Max is that good.
Really?
He's seriously, seriously good. And you can just look at his form. I know he's got thirds and fourths and fifths, and you might think, well, that's not great, is it? But he's doing it in a car that has no right, really, to be doing that.
So what's the prospect of eventually seeing those two as teammates?
Well, I wonder, at the end of next year, everyone's contract essentially is up for renewal. And it's very rare in Formula One that it all kind of lines up that way, so that everyone could technically move around quite a lot. And I think that I wonder whether if Lewis, say, has won 7 titles by the end of next year, and Verstappen's got tired of Red Bull, who've brought him through to Formula One, why would you not put Max next to Lewis? Because Max could be the future for Mercedes. Lewis will hopefully give him a good run, but is probably going to be on his way out in the year or two. That would be the chance to do it, and that would be a time when Lewis might accept it, because by then he's a 7-time world champion. He'll be riding on an air of confidence, and what a prospect that would be.
So when all these contracts start expiring, could we be looking at musical chairs?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think that's what's going to start happening probably early to the summer next year. You're going to start seeing a lot of drivers and a lot of motorhomes having a lot of coffee, and they're going to be having a few discussions.
A lot of flirting.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all going to be flirting with each other, and then you have to make the jump. Then you have to make your pick.
So how likely is it that Hamilton goes and flirts seriously?
I think if by the point of next summer he's a six-time world champion, probably going to get his seventh, I think it would be very likely he will speak to Ferrari. I think that, to be honest, I think that's the only team that he would talk to.
Because of that prestige.
Because of that prestige.
Well, Lawrence, it's absolutely flown by. We're at that point in the show where I need to press you for a quick prediction. Who's going to win the Austrian Grand Prix?
Right, I'm going bold. I'm going to say Charles Leclerc for Ferrari.
Right, we're going for a Ferrari win again. For once, don't let us down. Join us next week.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.